Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're still talking about Mayor Sheila Dixon's trial. As I said, the big issues will be after the trial, especially if she is acquitted. And we will be talking about why they even brought the case in the first place. We're talking about all kinds of political issues around developers and money, the ethics involved in this, whether she's acquitted or not, and more. But we're working our way through all that. Dwight Pettit is with us. He's a criminal defense attorney here in Baltimore, a name well known to many of us. Fern Shen, founder, editor, and publisher of the Baltimore Brew, and our own Melody Simmons, who is a reporter at WEAA and for the Center for Emerging Media, who's been covering the trial downtown. The number here is 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I want to remind you first, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Hospital for Children, offering primary, specialty, and critical care for all children, from the smallest babies to the biggest teenagers. For more information or to learn more about their specialty outpatient locations throughout the state of Maryland, call 1-800-492-5538. So let's, in fairness to our listeners, go right to the phones, let them have at us, 410-319-8888. James, you're on the air.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening, Jim.
Well, here we go. as Mr. Pettit stated, you never promise the jury something and don't deliver.
Right.
Because they give the defense something to really argue about, stating it was untrue from the very beginning, and their star witnesses, he was lying. But Mr. Lipscomb, to me, never appeared to be a credible anyway, for the simple fact he's such a brilliant businessman to get himself in this stupid position. And the jury surely was going to first think that he did this just to save his own neck. Today, when they made the move not to bring him forward, that killed the case. I wouldn't be surprised if the state's attorney dropped the whole entire case in the near future.
You mean the state prosecutor, right?
I think they're done. I think the jury is upset, and I know they're going home tonight saying they lied. They didn't have a case against her. And if the citizens of Baltimore aren't angry and upset about the way the city is, the condition of the city, they might have just helped her get reelected.
Yeah, the politics of this is going to be interesting to see as it unfolds after the trial. And you bring up Mr. Lipscomb, and I don't understand legally, Dwight, and maybe all three of you can comment on this, is, and try to get in Rohrbaugh's mind, the state prosecutor. I mean, you bring a case, you spent 3.5 years trying to build a case against the mayor. You had everything from this, where it started with her sister's company and getting a contract in the city when she was on the Board of Estimates as president of city council. And all the other accusations that took place. And it comes down to what may amount to a few hundred dollars worth of gift cards. I mean, and then he has his key witness, Ron Lipscomb, who rolled on his old girlfriend and said, I'm going to testify and get out of this myself. As his star witness, doing all the build-up to this trial, and then he didn't vet it enough to know what could be brought up? I mean, I can't quite figure out what went on here, Dwight.
It makes no sense, Mark. I mean, this is something that could cost a prosecutor his job in reality if it continues to come down like it has today and continues on that way. First of all, we go back to the fact that it should never been brought. The second trial is, in my opinion, is predicated largely on the first trial in terms of public opinion and in terms of politics. Now, some other lawyers have suggested to me, some very astute attorneys, within this short period of time, that this could have been a strategic move, and it was filed by the judge. In other words, he was going to hold Lipscomb for rebuttal, let the defense come on, let the defense put its case on, and then put Lipscomb on in rebuttal. But my thinking is strategically that was too far-fetched, although rebuttal is very discretionary and easily allowed by most judges. That's too much of a gamble to risk your whole case in chief by saying I'm a gamble and put him on in rebuttal. So I have to think that something came up much more disastrous than he had, or he had it, and argumentatively and stubbornly refused to let it persuade his decision-making until the last hour.
Now, what would cause the defense to bring up Lipscomb as a hostile witness? How would that transpire.
Well, I've heard that play out. He basically would, you classify him as a hostile witness, he basically becomes the defense witness, because then you can lead him, and once he has that classification, and get the testimony that's favorable to the defense. So that's the only reason that they would do that. But at this juncture, again, that's the same decision that has going to have to be made as to whether she testifies. I think more important than that, Mark, mm-hmm. is whether or not she's going to testify
right.
In face of this, because it's compelling arguments on both sides. And you make risk, like you said before, she may not be the best witness under cross-examination. So do you want to take that chance? There's a lot to be argued both sides, but the other side, of course, is that she remains silent and exercises her constitutional right. The judge will instruct the jury upon the defense's request to draw no guilt inferences because of the exercise of that constitutional right, and take your chances with the case being in the chaos that it is and go to the jury now. Or, again, go back to the motion for new trial, because I think Sweeney's wrong on that. I think the evidence is so tainted all the way that no instruction, no curative instruction can cure the damage that they've heard in terms of the evidence that has come in connected to the Lipscomb and the foundation of the opening statement of what was going to be proved through the Lipscomb testimony. I think that is disastrous. I think the Court of Special Appeals would reverse him if she ever got convicted at this point in time.
Let me go back to the phones on this. Fern Shen or Melody Simmons wants to chime in on that. We'll go back to the phones.
I agree totally with Dwight, and I know that they argued very aggressively for the mistrial, and the judge did not allow it, and basically saying about the tainted, the jury pool is tainted. They've heard 4 days. They've sat and been bombarded with 4 days of Dorican and 4 days of Lipscomb, and then, poof, he's gone. So, it was just a very shocking day in court. I think more and more supporters of the mayor are showing up. These are childhood friends. I saw a group of childhood friends there today.
Right.
People are there to lend support to her. So there's a growing movement also happening at the Mitchell Courthouse, too.
I'll let one of my one of the poets who entered a poem here, it seems like this is the right moment to read this haiku from someone who calls himself Skeptic.
Okay.
State prosecutor looked for bribes, found Best Buy card. Epic fail, Rohrbaugh? Epic fail.
That's great.
That's how Skeptic sizes it up.
I love it. That's great. That's great. I love it. And let me, just before we go to our callers, I want to say that what you just heard, Fern Shen, who started the Baltimore Brew, has a contest going on the Baltimore Brew. The best poem gets a couple of gift cards, one from Giant, one from Best Buy, if you win the best poem describing this trial.
I thought it was a great medium. It's very democratic. You can be pro-Sheila, anti-Sheila.
Right.
You can be, this was a waste of money. You can be, we've got to take a stand against the graft somehow. Wherever you come down, you can write a poem.
So just log on to
www.baltimorebrew.com.
And have at it. It's a good poem. 4-1. And we will read the winning poem, or have the winning poet read it on the air. How's that?
Sure.
We'll do
sure.
that. 410-319-8888. And let's go to Bill. You're on the air.
Yeah, how's that?
Bill, can you turn your radio off, please, or down? Bill? Bill, you there? Bill? We lost Bill. Let's go to C3, or they mean C4. I don't know. We'll find out in a minute. You're on the air.
Hello, Mark.
Hi.
Dwight, this is C3, as in father of C4.
Gotcha. How are you, Clarence? I wasn't sure they had it right or wrong then. That's good. Welcome. Good to have your voice in the air.
Long time listener, first time caller. You have a tremendous show,
Thank
Mark,
you.
As you always have through the years, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And, of course, you have the master, Dwight, on there with you, and I just wanted to
Thank you, Senator.
Reconfirm his position on this whole situation and reconfirm it from the position I was in the Maryland Senate and served on the Judicial Proceedings Committee when we created the Office of Special Prosecutor. And one of the biggest arguments against the creation of that office and the purpose of you know, this was a rush to do something after the Mandel situations, and the argument against it was that a special prosecutor would use this office for political purposes and not for the purposes of actually going after offenses that would rise to the level of prosecution. This is a crazy prosecution, and as you know, I maybe aware that I didn't support Sheila for mayor.
Right.
But I wasn't against her. I was for somebody else, my nephew. But she has done a great job as mayor since she's been in there. And as I have watched Robar and the special prosecutor move, I have been reminded of the arguments that many of my colleagues made against the creation of this office, that it could be misused. And it is in this situation being totally misused. And I think the prosecutors were hoping to bring Sheila to the point of, or our mayor, to the point of entering a plea or something because of the nature of what they've come up with. But this is ridiculous. And it's a charade. Which, as Dwight said a few minutes ago, that certainly hearkens for the reconsideration again of abolishing the special prosecutor's office.
I mean, there's an argument to be made there, too. I mean, that maybe a special prosecutor can be appointed as needed, whether or not
he's
in office or not, I mean, to appoint as needed in cases that come up. And maybe what we need is a stronger ethics commission or something. But, I mean, this
well, you had the same situation, Mark, in the Larry Young case. They had no real case against Larry Young. But because they brought the case politically, they were able to get the president of the Senate to push expelling Larry Young before he ever went to trial. And when he did go to trial, he was found not guilty.
Right.
There was no way of, you know, where does he go to get his reputation back and his name back after having gone through that and the experience of and the finances and all that sort of thing? It's ridiculous.
And Clarence makes a very, very strong position. I mean, is it duplicative of what already exists? You have the U.S. Attorney's Office, and it's very interesting here, and not only that, but you have the Attorney General's Office, you have the State's Attorney's Office. Now, in this particular case, the U.S. Attorney's Office has already done this investigation.
Right.
And terminated it. So, you know, you have to wonder when the state special prosecutor picked it up, was it being picked up after an exhaustion by the U.S. Attorney's Office? Was it being picked up simply for political opportunity?
I'm sorry, Senator. We have to go to another caller, but I hope you'll. I'd like to have you on as a guest one day, just to sit and talk
I'd love to, Mark, because I did a whole report when I was president of the National Black Caucus of State Legislators. On the harassment of African-American elected and appointed officials throughout the country. And they went after mayors all over the country, these prosecutors. And it was obviously an effort to do through the prosecutorial process what they couldn't stop through the elective process, and that is the election of more African-American public officials.
State Senator Clarence Mitchell III, lovely to hear your voice on the air. Thank you so much for calling in.
God bless you.
Take care.
Good to hear from you, my brother.
Doug Corbett is also on the line with us now. Doug, welcome.
Sorry for being so late, but I've had some
traveling
difficulties.
That's all right. That's fine. Did she win her soccer game?
Yeah, well, that's
an honor.
How you doing, Dwight?
Hi, Doug. I'm fine. Thank you.
Doug Corbett's professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law. So, Doug, we've been talking about this a great deal, and I don't know if you heard any of the program.
I have. I've been listening.
So tell me what your take is. I mean, you know, we're saying that this case over.
Well, I've been listening to it, and I just, and of course, none of us really know what's going on in the minds of the lawyers, and we don't know the cases as well as the people who have been living this trial for a long time. But I did want to suggest another perspective that might explain what the prosecutor's doing here. And it is a different take than the one that's been presented so far. The way, I mean, I was there for opening argument, and the prosecutor did not ever mention Mr. Lipscomb. In fact, it was surprising. He mentioned Doricon Construction, and he talked about Doricon as having contributed gift cards, but not once did he mention Lipscomb's name, which I thought was surprising. When the defense gave their opening argument, the whole thrust of Mr. Wiener's pitch was to tell the jury, just wait. Wait until Mr. Lipscomb gets here. Then you'll really understand what this case is about. We're not denying that the mayor used the gift cards. We're saying that she had a reasonable belief that she could use the cards in any way she wanted. And the defense painted Lipscomb as basically taking advantage of the mayor, of doing it for his own purposes. And the defense had every reason to believe that the jury was not going to like Mr. Lipscomb. Among other reasons, a married man who's doing a full court press on the mayor is not someone who's going to be found to be terribly attractive to a jury consisting of 9 women.
You don't think so, huh?
There's a lot of strategy going on here. Dwight understands the way that trials work. And any of us who have been before juries, we know there's a lot of things going on in that courtroom. So the way I read the prosecution move today was, it was a strategy decision. By losing 2 of the 7 charges, both counts against Mr. Lipscomb, you take Lipscomb out of the trial. You basically undermine the defense, which has promised the jury. This is the promise defense lawyers should never make. But the defense promised the jury that they're going to hear from Lipscomb. And when they do, you're going to get a very live cross-examination. Well, by sacrificing 2 of the charges, you take Lipscomb out of the picture, and from a prosecution point of view, what they want the jury to do is only be looking at the mayor, at the defendant, to see what she did, to see whether there's any substance to this defense that seems to me would have come in either through Lipscomb or through the mayor. So I looked at this as a strategic decision. We get rid of 2 charges, we get rid of Lipscomb, let the jury focus, on the 5 other charges, which are much more straightforward.
That's, if it would work, it would be brilliant, Professor. But that's a long-range gamble for the state of mind that the jury's in now.
It may be all
that. But
have.
You know, Dwight,
well,
sometimes we may not give the strategist enough credit. I don't know if this was what was going on. But if you don't want Lipscomb to be under cross-examination for 2 days or for a long 1 day, you basically remove him and you say to the jury, look, you have Turner who came to court. He told you what he did. He told you that he gave the cards to the mayor. They were supposed to be used for the poor. All I'm suggesting is I wouldn't sell the prosecution as short.
Well, let me ask you this, Professor. What about Mark's question of them bringing Lipscomb back in the defense part of the case?
That's interesting. You see, the ball is in the defense court right now, Dwight,
right.
And that's interesting. They could do one of 3 things right now. They can go with their character witnesses and end with their character witnesses and leave the jury with a very favorable impression of Mayor Dixon. She's an honest woman. Honest people do not do what she's charged with doing. And they can argue reasonable doubt, and that would be the end of the case. Or they could say, we're not sure we have reasonable doubt. The jury may want to hear from someone who's going to say that the mayor did have a reasonable belief that she could use these cards. There's only 2 people who can do that. One is the mayor, and the other is to call Lipscomb as a defense witness, get the court to declare him hostile, cross-examine him, lead questions, and then come back and say to the jury, you see, folks, this is why the prosecution didn't call Mr. Lipscomb. You got to see him. You got to hear him. You got to see what kind of a person he is. So I think there's a lot of possibilities here. I'm not willing to say that the case is over by a long shot.
Well, let me, in the next 5 or 6 minutes we have, I'm curious to see what Melody and Fern think about what they just heard. Our two attorneys here say, by the way, numbers here, 410-319-8888, to bring your thoughts to the airwaves again. Melody?
Well, I certainly think the professor has a great strategy here. This is what's going on on the press row. There's a lot of debate going on, like what in the world is happening? But I do think the ball is in the defense court. I think that the defense attorneys were totally caught off guard. They were shocked. They were stunned. They asked for more time. They weren't granted it. So basically, they are working very hard tonight. They're going to be burning that midnight oil on trying to figure out how to regroup and come back and what to do tomorrow. You know, will they put the mayor on the stand? Will they just rest their case first thing and send it to the jury after the closing? So we don't really know, but there is that element of surprise.
Fern?
My quick take, Ezra, I sounds like we're closing out here, but I'm coming from the court of not the court, but the court of public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am reflecting what I see in these poems. Doug, I don't know if you heard this, my website, where we have a contest. People can write poems about the trial, what they think of it. They can win a gift card if they have the best one. And I think a lot of the people in here, although not all of them, leaving aside whether this was a good case that's going to stand, it probably isn't, there's a sort of a bad odor that comes off of, you know, people calling up, the mayor calling up somebody in the Cayman Islands and asking for envelopes of cash, and developers with fur coats for a mayor who's making decisions about what they do.
No, what they didn't do in the prosecutor's case, which we will maybe get into in the next few days and when the trial is over,
mm-hmm.
they never made... I thought they'd be making connections between...
They didn't do it much. It was surprising.
Developers, cash, influence in city government, things that really...
Well, that's more the second trial, isn't it?
That's the second trial. You're right, Dwight. Absolutely.
Yeah, so, but is there a second trial if this trial doesn't work?
I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, I think they really rolled the dice high on this because they didn't present a quid pro quo. And without the quid pro quo, that left a lot of holes. It was almost like Swiss cheese from day one.
So if that's the case, again, do you think there was it strategically the prosecutor didn't think this thing through or made a mistake in dividing these cases up?
It's hard to say. I asked Mr. Rohrabaugh today, you know, how much he had spent of the taxpayers' money over 3.5 years.
And what did he say?
He just looked at me and goes, I don't know. He goes, I don't
know.
Answer questions like that.
I guess he doesn't. Doug and Dwight, very quickly.
Yeah, you know, Mark, I get the sense that people, all of us, I suppose, no matter how we try, we always seem to come into a situation with certain prejudgments or preconceived ideas about what happened. You know, people who felt that this prosecution shouldn't have been brought, you know, will certainly be ringing the bells loudly for no more prosecution of the mayor. And people who felt that the charge of an elected official misusing or appropriating property that was intended for other people are going to have a different view. The people who are in that courtroom, day in and day out, are hearing the evidence. And that's what none of us are there full time.
It takes me back in closing and saying the most important part of this trial was the jury selection
and
the composition of the jury.
Right. And I think Mr. Weiner did really well in that.
Yes, he did.
It seems he did. Well, we will continue obviously covering this until it is over, and we'll do an analysis of it all when it's done. Whether that analysis takes place Thursday or Friday, or Thursday or Monday, and I'm sure that my colleague Anthony McCarthy will be covering this as well on Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. And when the trial ends, that'll be happening. I'll be on the road that day, so I won't be able to join Anthony for that, but we'll be back Monday to talk about this and talk about it again tomorrow and Thursday, seeing where all this takes us. We don't know where it's going to take us. I do want to thank our guest today. I really want to thank Dwight Pettit for coming into the studio. Great to see you, Dwight.
My pleasure, Mark. Good to see you.
Great to see you. Doug Colbert, thanks for for joining us. We're looking forward to more of your commentary.
Thank you, Mark.
And Melody Simmons, thank you for covering all this stuff for us and being the great reporter you are, working for us and getting this done.
Thank you.
And Fern Chen, thank you for joining us. And I want to encourage everybody to go to BaltimoreBrew.com and log on there and write your poem. Maybe you'll get a gift card, and you won't go to trial court for it either. So,
I bought them with cash. I made sure of that.
Okay, good. Thank you all so much for joining us here. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Stop by one of its 7 branches or go to MECU.com for more information. We'll be right back to meet some people who are really trying their best to do good things for this community. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. The Open Society Institute Baltimore does a lot of work in our community. One of the things they started back in 1998 was the Baltimore Community Fellowships. They create fellows every year that of people who really want to involve their lives in change and helping people change their lives and dedicate themselves to communities. They give them a fellowship for a year and a half to be able to work full time at whatever the projects that they're working on. And these projects have really made a difference in people's lives over the year. I've known many OSI fellows over the years, interviewed many of them, worked with many of them in the things that they have created, and they just do an incredible amount of work. And we will meet all these fellows over the course of a period of time. And we're starting with 3 today. There'll be some more joining Anthony McCarthy on Friday on his show as well, 5 to 7 p.m. And I know some of these fellows, one who's not here today, who I'd love to have on the show soon as well, is Sarah Heminger, who's done this incredible work at Dunbar High School, and she's been made a fellow, so she's going to do even more work. She showed what one woman can do if you sit yourself down in an inner city school and say you can make a difference in young people's lives. She's done it, and that she's been recognized as a fellow. And so this hour we're going to talk to these 3 fellows because we want to hear what people want to do about changing their lives and changing the lives of others and making a difference in this city. We hear all the problems all the time, but we also have to hear from people who are working to resolve those problems. That's what's critical, the people on the ground working for change in people's lives. We're joined in studio now by 3 of those newly chosen fellows in this new class. Rhonda Elsie Jones is working with the National Women's Project to start a program called WHOLE, Women Healing Our Lives Entirely, which we'll hear about. Melissa Ruoff, who's developing Jubilee Arts, a center for the arts across the street from her home in Sandtown, Winchester, that will feature classes in the arts for neighborhood residents. And Melissa Ruoff, welcome as well. Good to have you here. And Dwayne Hess, who grew up on a Mennonite dairy farm in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Do I have that right?
That's right.
And is developing the Neighborhood Spiritual Center in a previously vacant building in southwest Baltimore. He was a teacher of Baltimore City for 6 years. So we want to hear about all these programs. And Dwayne, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Well, first of all, congratulations to all of you for becoming fellows. This is great. Your just work sounds amazing. I'm going to ask you some questions you might not expect this hour about what you think about certain things, but I want to hear about your work really. Let's start with Rhonda Elsie Jones. The work I understand you're doing is with women who are survivors of sexual abuse or have witnessed domestic violence. And so talk a bit about your life and this work and what you're going to be doing.
I'm a survivor of trauma. Mm-hmm. I got involved in this work in 2001. I worked for a program called Tamar's Children.
Oh, yeah, I know that program very well.
Okay.
Yeah. It was with women in prison who have children, right?
Right.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And from there, I just stayed involved in the trauma movement. Last year, I worked with Center for Mental Health Services developing a national trauma awareness campaign that was just funded. So there'll be more advertisement on trauma and how it affects you and how it oftentimes looks like mental health disorders and how to heal from trauma. So I'm working with a population of women who are coming from jail or have had contact with jail. And my program is a wellness program so that they can finally learn to heal and not be stuck in a trauma.
Were you one of Tamar's? Were you in Tamar's program, or you just worked in Tamar's program?
I worked there. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the healing from trauma is. I mean, it's. having worked with and know a lot of veterans who've gone through it and women who have gone through horrible trauma or children going through trauma, I mean, it's one of the most difficult things to do, is to help work your way through that and lead people out.
I think it's most difficult because of the secrets.
The secrets that you hold inside,
yes,
you
mean? Mm-hmm. Very few people talk about or even are offered an opportunity to talk about the experience that they've had. And what I know is that when people are given the opportunity, they usually take it. But it's the having to keep the secrets because you're being abused. And, you know, it just you just never stop keeping the secrets. And oftentimes even people who are in therapy don't actually get a chance to talk about the experiences that they've had because they're usually dealing with the diagnosis that they've been given.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start talking about it and getting it out and doing body work or trauma work and things
like
that.
What do you mean by body work? What's body work?
Meditation, yoga, massage, getting into the body, being present moment oriented. And that's what often trauma survivors aren't. They are either in the future or in the past. Oftentimes, they don't know emotions. So once you start learning emotions and learning to be in the here and now, it's a lot easier to heal because you don't keep, you're not revisiting the experience over and over and over and becoming overwhelmed with it over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let me turn to Melissa Ruoff as we'll work our way around the table here.
Okay.
Melissa, and I should have known when I saw your name that it was who you were, but it didn't hit me. It was Ruoff. What's the relation to? And you are.
That's right. Wife of.
Great man. I love him. I love him dearly.
So do I.
I always call him my closet priest. So I. we'll talk about the program that you are, this Jubilee Arts, and what that is in Sandtown.
Jubilee Arts is a community art program which will be providing classes in ceramics, visual arts, creative writing, and dance for children and adults in the community. And it's really where it wells up from in me is that I've been a musician all my life, performing and teaching.
What do you play?
Violin.
Mm-hmm.
And in the teaching in particular, it is has become so obvious to me over the years that being able to learn a craft or be involved in the arts in some way is so enriching and so helpful to the development of our children's minds, and that our country doesn't seem to, as a kind of a general rule, understand that. And so for years, I've wanted to create a place where people could come and do music, do painting, do creative writing, do dance, all of it. Because I know, even though I'm a musician, I know that all of the arts provide that opportunity for people. So when Fred and I became involved in the community over in Sandtown, and I met Elder Harris, C.W. Harris, who is a dancer and who has lived in Sandtown for his entire life and who has longed to bring back the culture of that Pennsylvania Avenue corridor.
It was a very important place when I was a kid.
Yeah. The two of us joined our calls together and started working on developing this center.
So what will the kids do? Young, will it be just kids or adults?
No,
as well?
It'll be a kids and adults.
So what will they do in the center?
They will do dance. We have classes for ballet and hip-hop and praise dance, Chicago stepping, urban ballroom, Lindy hop. We have creative writing, especially for adults right now, for people who want to get in touch with their inner poet. We have a wonderful partnership with MICA, the Maryland Institute College of Art, and people there will be teaching painting and drawing, and we have a partnership with Baltimore Clay Works, which, as you know, just brings a tremendous amount to community. And
Deborah Bedwell's done a great work down there.
Yes, and so we're excited about that partnership as well.
Let me turn to Duane Hess. And you're going to be working on South Mount and West Pratt Street, is that right?
That's correct.
Which is a tough area.
Some say it's tough. Yeah.
I like that already. So the obvious question I have to ask you is, what's a good Mennonite boy like you doing on the corner of Mount and West Pratt?
That's a good question. Yeah, I've been there 16 years, and I still, you know, dig in the earth in my backyard. I have a garden, connects me to my
farm
roots. Yeah, mm-hmm. But I love the city. I love where I live and work right up the street. Now this is sort of a dream come true to be able to be at the center full time. So
talk about that work you're doing. What is this work you're going to be doing there?
Yeah, the Neighborhood Spiritual Center is operated by a new faith community. It's a nonprofit that bought an old storefront building, and we've been slowly converting it into a multi-purpose center. And we call it a spiritual center because it has a holistic approach to healing and to being, so that when we offer GED classes, which is one of the things we want to do, it's not just about education, but it's about, you know, the whole person being able to make improvements with their lives. We have a coffee house currently on Thursday evenings and Saturday mornings where everyone is welcome to just stop in, have a cup of coffee. We don't have takeouts because the purpose is to just spend some quality time in a safe space. And then there's a lot of other ideas that we have floating around that are hopefully going to be coming to fruition with this, you know, with this fellowship related to nutrition, related to also some of the things the other two of my fellows here mentioned in their centers, some body work, some art, that kind of thing as well.
So you call it a spiritual center, that's what I keep hearing, right? So talk, what does that mean? When is it? What do you mean by a spiritual center?
Well, the group that formed kind of came out of some different religious traditions, and we we're not trying to criticize religion at all. We were just finding that within ourselves some of the limitations of religion, but connected to the spiritual part, and so. As we meet together, whether it's no matter what it is, whether it's classes or whether it's coffee house or whether it's a discussion group, there's an element of connecting spiritually, thinking of ourselves, and as in sort of the whole sense of how our bodies, minds, and spirits are all connected.
So the three of us ask this question. I mean, you've all used one thing that is similar in all three of the things that you've talked about, which is the whole. Person, holistic look at the way we live our lives and kind of approaching all three of your very different kind of projects that way. And we look at a lot of inner city neighborhoods, inner city worlds. There's are a lot of devastated people, good people, but really who...
Wounded.
That's a much better word, Rhonda, than I used. Wounded is a much better way of describing it. People wounded by the trauma of poverty, the trauma of prison, the trauma of their lives, the trauma of the streets, trauma of trying to survive.
Yes.
So talk. I'm curious about how that speaks to you and what good. And I'm trying to be, you know, facetious here, but what good will you do there? In other words, what good will the work that you really do there, giving the overwhelming issues that people face?
Part of my program is the women who I work with, who I'll be working with. The plan is to work with each group 6 months. But that group will then come back and help me work with the next group and the next. Mm. The premise is each one teach one. Mm-hmm. And if when they learn what wellness is, then... the last 2 months of their six, they're able to bring in their family, their significant other. But if you aren't healed and whole, then you don't have as much to give. So as you heal, then you're able to help heal the next person. And I believe when they learn that, then it can change the city or the community a whole lot. Because there are a lot of wounded people who don't even know they're wounded.
Right.
And when you are able
or
to talk to someone
wounds, right.
from the heart, they feel it in the heart. And as they learn, as they are healed, they will be able to speak to the heart, I believe.
So I have another question. I'm sure other people think about this whole question of wholeness and what does that really mean? I mean, because all right, some people will hear this and go, oh, this sounds so like touchy-feely, really hardcore problems, but how is this really going to touch? You know what I'm saying? So
it's more like a lifestyle. It's speaking positively, thinking positively, acting positively. It's not just a theory or concept. Mm-hmm. It's a way of living. It's a way of speaking. It's a way of eating, and on and on and on. And the more positive things you tell yourself, the better your behavior becomes. The more you believe it, the better you act, and on and on and on.
And with the arts, we are such complicated creatures.
Human beings.
Yes.
Yes, we are.
Yes. And we don't always get the chance to explore the huge universe that lies within. And through the arts, I believe that everyone can discover things about themselves, strengths about themselves, which go along with what you're talking about, that will give them more tools to work with. And we're hoping that people will learn skills that they'll be able to use in a more materialistic way to find different ways of making money for themselves. But more importantly, to go in there and discover more about your strengths and what you have, and to give people more a larger landscape mm-hmm. to work with, more paths to go down.
Mm-hmm. What I really like about our neighborhood center is the mixture of tangible and intangible, meaning, if a person gets their GED because they came in for GED classes or they learn English for the first time, that's something tangible that they can use. And then on the other hand, like in our coffee house, we've had just almost every week someone will come into the coffee house and they'll look around and they'll hear the music in the background and they'll just be like, wow, this, I can just be at peace here.
What kind of music is in the background?
It's some old school jazz most of the time, mm-hmm. a little Coltrane, Thelonious Monk. So
good stuff.
Yeah, it's some good quality. So those kinds of, it's not easy to measure what that person left with who came in and said, wow, this is just peaceful, you know.
You see, what you're talking about here, and by the way, I want to get listeners to join us here at 410-319-8888. We're talking with three of the new Open Society Institute fellows who are doing great work in this community. While they're chosen to be fellows who help them, pay them to do their work over the next year and a half to develop their centers. We just heard Dwayne Hess, Rhonda Elsie Jones is with us, and Melissa Ruoff, 410-319-8888. Bring your thoughts to the airwaves to share with our guests. I mean, because we always hear about programs and job training programs, you said GED programs, these kinds of things all the time. But what we never hear about are programs that work on people's inner selves, on their souls, on what, I think of some of the work I watched friends of mine do in some inner city neighborhoods, and it's this friend of mine, Dante Wilson, who just, when kids come in, he sits and lets them do their mind dumps to listen to what they're saying and help them work through what they're facing to kind of be able to face their lives. And that's what you're talking about in some ways, is trying to do inner work, mm-hmm. not just.
Right.
And Melissa, when we started talking, she was telling me about Jubilee. I said, everything that I wanted to, some of the things that I want to do. So we're going to work together. The women that I work with are going to go to the center and do some art.
Yes. And they'll be able to join with the women at Martha's Place, yeah. which is a sister mission of my sponsoring organization.
Right. And with Martha's Place, these are women who are recovering from addiction, right?
That's right. That's right. And
a residential program.
Yes.
One of the few for women.
That's right. 6 months right. residential program. Very good. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And who are the people involved with you, Dwayne?
Are you talking about the people that are coming in or the people
who are working with you? I mean, you said there was a number of people you came in who came from different religions and different places, and you were trying to find a spiritual, not necessarily religious path to with your work?
Yeah.
Who are these people?
Well, it's a mixture of people. There's some of us are from Baltimore, born and raised. Some are from other places like myself and have moved in Baltimore. Most of us, I would say about 80 to 90% of the people involved in the organization can walk to the center on Mount and Pratt Streets. And we're just a group of people who are, we love people.
So how do you think people perceive you? I mean, you know, I mean, it's in the communities. I mean, it's, you know, that you're not here organizing rent strikes. You're not, you know what I'm saying? I mean, some, you're not like going in as a political or community organizer necessarily. You're going in a very different way, the three of you. So how do people think view you in this community?
Well, I've been working with survivors of trauma for quite a while. Most of the time without pay.
Mm-hmm.
But
it'd be a pleasant change, won't it?
Yes, it will. It's a pleasant change to be able to work in Baltimore City. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was traveling a lot and doing a lot of workshops. People see me as calm. A lot of them like
my
voice. They say I have a very calming voice.
Mm-hmm.
I listen well. I'm not judgmental. So it's a relief for them. And it's a relief that now I can be available more. So I think they feel really good about it.
I don't know how they feel about me personally, but I know how they feel about Jubilee Arts. They're very excited, and it fills them with hope, and they just immediately start thinking about what it will do for their children. But then their second thought is, but I can be involved too. I mean, there's just a lot of excitement. So if as much as I'm involved with Jubilee Arts, maybe they see me with a measure of hope. I don't know.
Yeah, I would say something similar. A lot of people are very excited about what we're doing, and people will ask me about, you know, when our class is going to start, or
what are the classes again? By them, I'm sorry.
Like GED or English as a second language classes, literacy classes. So those are some of the classes that I will offer. That's my background.
Mm-hmm.
There will be other things too related to health and nutrition and arts and so on. So, but yeah, I'm not sure exactly what people would say about me personally.
I just meant the idea that you're there and the work that you, I mean, I think that people don't realize that people, I mean, that there's so little in those neighborhoods. The resources about, I mean, I mean, whether it's no supermarkets and no health clinics and no places for kids to go take art and music and no places for people who are in pain just to go to kind of work through what they're going through. I mean, they're not there.
I also am a holistic practitioner.
What does that mean?
I'm a massage therapist,
mm-hmm.
a Reiki master. I do some other alternative things. And because I've experienced what they've experienced, it gives them a sense of hope. And that's all they want, I believe, is a sense of hope and a belief that things can get better. My nieces and nephews or my grandchildren may not have to have the experiences that I've had.
Break the cycle.
Right. And that is the plan, the hope, the belief. To break the cycle.
Maybe when the phone's here, let our listeners come in and join part of this conversation. 410-319-8888. You just heard Rhonda Elsie Jones. Dwayne Hess is with us. Melissa Ruoff. All three of them, the new Open Society Institute fellows who are creating programs in our communities. Rhonda Elsie Jones is working with the National Women's Prison Project, and she's starting a program called Whole Women Healing Our Lives Entirely. Melissa Ruoff is developing Jubilee Arts in Sandtown, Winchester, where she lives. A center for arts right across from our home to people in excess, arts, music, dance, and more. Dwayne Hess is developing a neighborhood spiritual center at the corner of South Mount and West Pratt in a formerly vacant building. He used to be a school teacher. 410-319-8888 is number here. And Yvonne, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted some more information.
Mm-hmm.
Got a little bit of information. I'm kind of listening and
sure.
And kind of doing other things. Because first, frankly, I have some little things that I go through daily, and I'm going through right now, that I think create inner trauma that we don't always get a chance to talk about. So, I mean, it gave me some information that I would like to have. About who do you help? What kind of people do you help? What ages do they have to be? Because I work with people that go through a whole lot of different things, different age groups that I think could really use this kind of help. And so I just wanted to know what kind of people do you help? What kind of situations do you help? And how can we get more information?
Rhonda Elsie Jones.
The number that I can be reached on is 410-233-3385. And the name of the organization is National Women's Prison Project. So you can call me and we can talk about it.
So that's 410-233-3385. We'll put that on our website as well, so people who have computer access can log on and find out how to contact Rhonda Elsie Jones if you want to need her program, be part of it, learn more about how to be involved. 410-319-8888. Adrian, you're on the air.
I had the pleasure of meeting you a couple years ago through the Department of Justice. The Justice Department with Laverne Blackman. I was on your show.
Oh, my show.
And,
okay, right.
It was quite some time ago about offenders. And I'm an ex-offender, and I've been home now for about 4 years. And I know this. I know the director of the Women's Prison Project. In fact, Ms. Rita was very instrumental in helping me get involved with the reentry program. Mm-hmm. And now, I've been home 4 years, as I mentioned. I'm married, got a home, and I have a program that my wife and I founded called We Can Achieve. We consult, we mentor, and we provide educational services. And it's just so amazing how, as you evolve, out here and with a clear head, and how you see the need for people who have experienced incarceration and poverty, drugs, right, and gangs, and how it's now the cycle has to be broken, because if it's not broken, what's going to happen? It's like an infectious germ, that it gets in these kids, and these kids depict characteristics that turns into a snowball effect that destroys generations.
Well, Adrian, we're almost out of time, but so I appreciate the call, and I'd like to turn to our guests. I mean, that's one of the things Adrian brings up here, and we all only have a few minutes left, is that to explore the idea for a minute about how the work you do can change that, you hope can change that way of feeling. When I get to my 12-year-old, she'll teach me how to turn this off. How do you think you can affect that whole mindset and the way, that kind of culture of fear that's taken over in neighborhoods?
I think one of the things with our neighborhood center that I haven't mentioned before is the idea of community. When people come in on a regular basis for a cup of coffee, eventually there's the chance to establish community and to be able to get involved more. And I know in my own life, having people around me who will listen to me and will take time to understand what I'm going through is a way that has helped me to make changes in my life that I needed to make, and I think it's another way that our center will be able to effect change as well.
I look forward to learning a great deal more in the coming year about all your work and meeting you all again and coming down to visit your places and see what you do.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dwayne Hess, Melissa Ruoff, Rhonda Elsie Jones, thank you so much for being with us, and thank OSI for doing what they do to put these people and help these people do the work that they do.
And thank you for having us.
It's great
thank
to have you,
very
you all
much.
Here. I want to invite you all to join me this Saturday night. Two shows, Voices of a People's History. I'll be playing one role, be many roles being played there by many people that you love. Two shows, 6 and 9 p.m. At Creative Alliance. Call 410-276-1651 and join us down there. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producer is Justin Levy. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, and Gay Pinder. Theme music by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. More information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. For Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM. the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Stay involved. Take care.